evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Authors Access, where authors get published and published authors get successful. Hi, I'm Irene Watson, and I am the managing editor of Fur Read Reviews in Austin, Texas.
And I'm Victor Volkman from Loving Healing Press in Ann Arbor, Michigan. It's June 19th, 2008, and welcome to episode number 65 in our series. Tonight's topic is By the Numbers, and our special guest will be joining us tonight is me, Victor Volkman. You can learn more about our guest on the Authors Access website, which is authorsaccess.com. Please send us your questions and comments to info@authorsaccess.com.
Victor Volkman is the president of Loving Healing Press Incorporated, a small publisher which has been dedicated to producing self-help, psychology, trauma recovery, and personal growth books since 2003. Loving Healing Press has produced more than 60 titles covering such diverse areas as physical disabilities, medicine and alternative health, abuse recovery, mindfulness, and critical incident stress management. Their books are sold in USA, Canada, and the United Kingdom via Ingram, Baker & Taylor, Bertram's Books, Quality Books, New Leaf Distributing, and other distributors. The overall mission is statement is simply redefining what is possible for a healing mind and spirit. Victor is the author of 6 books on topics from psychology to computer programming. Wow, that's quite a broad spectrum there. And his next book will be called Power Publishing. Wow, I had no idea you were going to be doing a book on power publishing. I'm looking forward to that. Hi, Victor.
Hi, Irene. Yeah, it's kind of a perpetual work in progress, but you know, I want to share my secrets of success with other people because, you know, just because I did everything through the school of hard knocks doesn't mean everyone else should have to.
Well, gosh, so this is actually going to be directed towards self-publishing or other publishers or just publishing in general, sort of the industry information. What direction are you going into?
Well, it would be ideal for someone who wanted to self-publish or if they had the notion to start their own small press. It's basically all of the secrets that you need to know to get the job done right.
Wow, that's great. And when do you expect this book to be ready for publication?
You know, I'm going to put a stick in the ground and say September 2008.
Okay, I'm going to hold you to that.
Okay.
And this actually just leads us right into publishing, because today we're going to be talking about some of the things that we haven't covered before in our topics in the last 2 years. And basically, right down to the basics. And you know, this is funny because the question I'm going to ask you is, what is ISBN? And I think that we think that everybody knows exactly what it is because we're so used to this in the publishing world. However, I did have a reviewer ask me this the other day, and actually she was a teenager that just is coming on as a reviewer. She had no idea what an ISBN was, or even where to find it. So let's start with that, because if there's one person that doesn't know, I'm sure there are others.
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's almost one of the first things that you run into, which is why I have it really quite towards the beginning of my book. And the way it turns out is all books that have been published since 1970 and which are sold commercially are labeled with the International Standard Book Number, or ISBN. Now, this is a true international standard, because it's deployed in nearly 150 countries around the world. Now, an ISBN number not only designates a book, but it also designates a particular format of a publication. For example, paperback, hardcover, audiobook, or ebook. Now, this stems from the development of ISBN as a warehouse coding system. So its purpose is not academic, like the Dewey Decimal System, but it's to ensure that a customer receives the exact book that he or she has ordered. And ISBN exists as a subset of the famous Universal Product Code, UPC, which we've all been had the barcodes on your groceries when you check out every day.
Oh, I was going to say, so, okay, I'm seeing this number, and the only one that I know is 978, because all the ones since, what is it, 2 years ago, are all starting with 978 since the 13 digit. But there are dashes in between. So does that mean that each one of those codes of numbers between the dashes have some significance?
Or yeah, exactly, they do.
Oh, okay. Tell us.
978 is colloquially called Bookland, because each country has its own code, but 978 is dedicated only to books. So everything with a UPC code of 978 is specifically a book. But the problem is the way that they divided them up between all the regions in the world wasn't very efficient. So they ran out of space in the 978 designation, which still has, you know, seven digits, which should theoretically allow you to publish 10 million books, right? But it just wasn't divided efficiently. So that's why they went to a 13-digit standard, and they've taken over the number 979, which is starting to be used in Europe this year.
So just who are the they? You mentioned that they didn't do this efficiently, or they came up with the numbers, and who are the they?
That's a good question. There's a worldwide standards committee, which is in charge of the ISBN system. And like any of the international standards bodies that govern engineering or any scientific body there, each country has a specific representative. In USA, the representative has been delegated to a company called Bowker. Now, Bowker published a book called Books in Print, which was the first time that anyone in the U.S. tried to list all the books in print in one place. In 1948, they did this. And since they were sort of the authority, when 1970 rolled around and they had to figure out who was going to manage the ISBN numbers for people in the USA, it fell to them. But in Canada, they might have a governmental agency. Most countries probably have a governmental agency that's in charge of these.
Oh, well, that's interesting. So, but Bowker is, they're not a government agency, or are they?
No, they're a for-profit company. I don't know off the top of my head whether they're publicly traded, but I would suspect that they probably are.
So is that then where self-published authors or traditional publishers like yourself or whomever needs an ISBN would go to? You can actually buy them from Bowker?
Yeah, exactly. If you start out at ISBN.org and you click on, you know, buy me an ISBN set of numbers, you'll eventually end up on Bowker's website, and they'll give you a choice of buying them in a block of 10, 100, or 1,000 units, which essentially means that, you know, you sort of have a license to publish either 10, 100, or 1,000 titles, and that'll cost you either $245, $930, or $1,570. And really what you're buying is the rights to use a number, so that's really kind of expensive for a number, but it has a lot of use to it, so people put up with that. Although 30 years ago, I'm told there was no charge. But, you know, since now we're publishing 400,000 titles a year in the USA, it kind of adds up the administrative costs.
Oh, of course. And the administrative costs, I know all about that. So, but just what you're saying is, okay, so you, the minimum you can buy is 10. So are you saying then if I maybe want to self-publish a book and I only want to self-publish one book, I still have to buy 10 numbers?
The 10 numbers is your minimum order, and actually it goes by rather quickly, because suppose you start off with a hardcover edition, well, that'll use up one of your numbers. Then if you want to issue it in paperback, you'll need another one. If you want to produce an ebook, you should use a third number. If you want to produce an audiobook, well, now you've used 4 out of 10, and then it's probably time to do the second edition, so now you've used 5 out of 10 numbers. So they go by pretty quickly.
Well, when you put it in that perspective, yes, of course. In my mind, I was just thinking, well, one book, one number. But basically now, with, like you say, e-books or, you know, hardcover books, you're going to need another number. So it does make sense to have to buy. And a lot of writers also create another book because, you know, they're writers. There's always another book in hand that comes along. So as a self-publisher, then, it's really important to go to Bowker, buy this group of numbers, and have them on hand. Now, so as a traditional publisher, basically you do the same thing. You buy the numbers, but what other numbers do you need?
Well, yeah, the ISBN is sort of the tip of the iceberg. It's where you get started, and by owning it, it makes you what they call the publisher of record. And although people claim that only the publisher of record can sell a particular book, strictly speaking, the publisher of record is the only one who can place an order to print a book.
I was just going to say, just define what publisher of record is, because I'm already lost.
Right. by publisher of record, we're saying, by definition, a book may only have, a particular edition of a book only has one publisher. So a publisher of record is basically the entity that's legally licensed to publish this book by the author.
If it's
Stephen King and his new book is being published by Random House, Random House is the publisher of record. And if anyone needs to order a book, they can look up in Books in Print, which is also maintained by Bowker, the same people that sold you the ISBN, and they'll find you as the publisher of record.
Okay, that makes sense. Okay, so now we were going to, now that we know who the publisher of record is, we were going to then, we need other numbers for registration.
Right.
Okay.
Right, so as time goes by and you develop your book and you get it in sort of a galley form that's almost ready to be published, then you want to take a look at the other services that are available from the Library of Congress. And there's two sort of publisher support services. One is called Cataloging and Publication, or CIP, or actually we call it LCIP for Library of Congress Cataloging and Publication. And this program is designed to create bibliographic records for the forthcoming books most likely to be acquired by U.S. libraries. So if your book is not something that a library would ever consider, then you're not going to get much value out of cataloging in publication. The other program is called the Pre-Assigned Control Number, or PCN. So the bibliographic record is created by the Library of Congress, and it's sent to the publisher, and the publisher puts it in the book on what's called the verso, which is the back side of the title page. Because if you open any book, the back of the title page is supposed to have, it's supposed to be the copyright page, and it's supposed to have all the bibliographic data on there. Now, the other advantage of using the Library of Congress to generate your cataloging data instead of using, say, a third-party vendor is that the Library of Congress has this thing called the Cataloging Distribution Service, or CDS. Now, what the CDS is once a month, they gather up all of the bibliographic records that they've made in the past 30 days, and they push them out to all the libraries around the world. So libraries that are looking for specific kinds of books all of a sudden find out about the stuff that you put in their system.
Okay, so I have a question at this point here, a couple questions before we go any further, because I need clarity here. So, Library of Congress, is this a government agency, or?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. This, I don't know the exact history, but it basically, I think, goes back to the time of Thomas Jefferson, and was a great bibliophile himself, and he felt the need for a central repository for everything that was going to be published in the USA, because you know books were really the only store of knowledge before the internet. And since it was critical to the development of the democracy, you know, he created this institution. And it's all run by your taxpayer dollars.
Well, I'm glad to hear that my tax dollar is going towards the literary department, that's for sure. That's great.
Yeah.
Victor, you just mentioned something here that I needed to question before we go any further, and that's you
sure.
said that the Library of Congress has this list, then, and it is distributed to all the libraries.
Now, right.
So the libraries then have a list of all the books that have been published, let's say, for the past month. That's
right.
What I heard you say. Is that correct?
Yeah, although the cataloging is a pre-publication activity, which typically happens between about 1 and 9 months before the book comes out. So it's usually in the middle of the development of a book that there's enough content available to do the cataloging properly, but they still want to have it all done way in advance of the publication date.
So, the purpose of sending it to the library is because, now I want you to expand that.
Oh, okay. Well, is to have your book information known by libraries around the world, because then their buyers will be able to find out about your book. And really, it's the simplest and most direct way to reach potential library and institutional buyers. I mean, you can imagine that a library that specialized in, say, agricultural science, Autumn would be checking the lists, the catalog lists every month for new books on agricultural techniques or whatever. So it helps if your book is in a particular specialty. And also, the Library of Congress feeds the data back in to the Books in Print system. So when the next edition of Books in Print comes out, it'll have all the details about your book. So if someone's, you know, searching for books that have come out this year on a particular topic, they can easily find you.
So now I'm really confused, Victor. So, boy, do I need clarity, because...
Okay, I'm not helping.
No, you are helping, because I'm finally going to get it clear, and I'm sure that if I got the confusion, I'm not the only one.
Yeah,
at least
yeah.
I want to think that anyway. So, okay, the Library of Congress sends these lists to the library, so I'm wondering, why is it such a panic for authors and writers to get their list, their book into, let's say, the Book Review Index or all these other places that supposedly send their list to the libraries? I'm not, because already they have the list of all the new books that are coming out. So is that duplication? Does anybody actually look at all these other secondary lists that are sent in? Help.
Yeah, that's a good question. Because a book with a review available is really an order of magnitude more information than you knew before. I mean, basically, we're talking, you know, the basic cataloging record. If you open and look at the copyright page of any book, it'll tell you, you know, who's the author, the title, some information about the subject area, maybe, you know, how many pages it is, and so on. So it's really kind of... It doesn't have the amount of detail that a book review would give. So they're really serving like two different purposes.
Well, that makes sense then. So basically, with these other lists that go to the libraries or the libraries are subscribing to, it gives them more information. And basically, it's the review or the endorsements or the praises or whatever you want to call them. But it gives more information in what the actual reader, that particular reader, thinks of the book, and so this could be a selling feature also then. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Yeah, and one thing which I forgot to mention is that your small local library systems, they hate to do cataloging. If they had buy some books and the books aren't cataloged, they go sit in a pile somewhere waiting for someone to catalog them. It takes a lot of training and expertise to catalog a book, and you know your local library system can't afford to have a lot of full-time catalogers waiting around to catalog books. So by having catalog information in your book, literally all I have to do is open it up to the copyright page, type a few things into the computer, and your book will be searchable by the patrons in the library. So it does make it much more appealing.
Ah, okay. I often wondered how that worked in the library. Well, that makes sense. So, Victor, I just want to kind of backtrack a little bit, because earlier you had said Books in Print. Now, that's a registration central, is from what I understand. I just want you to expand a little bit more and let us know what really happens at Books in Print. And I think you said that it's a division of Bowker, is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay.
Back in the day, before we had this much online access, literally you would go to your local library and there'd be maybe a two or three volume set, and each volume be 4 inches, 5 inches thick, and it would, you know, be Books in Print for maybe, you know, 1978 through 1980, and authors A through L in one volume and M through Z in the other. Literally, it was just a book which contained information about other books. Well, now we do everything online, and when you buy your block of ISBN numbers, you also get a login to the Bowker's Books in Print website, where it's kind of your responsibility to enter in as much data as you can about each book as you get ready to print it, especially if it's a book that isn't going to be cataloged by the Library of Congress. Then you're 100% responsible for filling in the Books in Print data at that point.
And so when is the best time actually to register the book at Books in Print?
Pretty much, I mean, if when you have the, if you're a small publisher, you know, when the contract's signed and the manuscript is delivered, you're pretty much committed, and so you might as well get it, the information in there as soon as you can at that point. And you can always go back and fill in more information later, because some of it, like the number of pages, isn't going to be known until the very last second.
Right, and obviously
in the publishing cycle.
Yes, and obviously then there is a provision to actually say when the book is going to be printed and published and
available.
Yes. So let's say if somebody hears about a particular book, goes to a store, asks for it, the store actually can go into the computer system, go to the Books in Print, and then pull up that particular book and say, oh, it's not going to be published until October of 2008.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
Now, there actually are some marketing opportunities you can buy from Bowker. They're a little on the expensive side, so I've never done it, but you can have your book, you know, appear on their website as sort of, you know, an online ad. So when people are looking up book information, they might see an ad for your book, that kind of thing.
Oh, okay. So does anybody have access to the Books in Print? Can I, as a consumer, go there?
That's a good question. I'm going to say off the top of my head, I think that anyone can search it as a member of the public, but I'm just going to go there in my web browser and see how far I can get without logging in.
Okay.
So the Bowker.com is the main site, and then it gives you a bunch of choices. Are you a librarian? Are you a publisher? Are you an author? Are you a bookseller? So I'm going to pretend I'm a librarian here,
okay.
And it asks me which of 10 different kinds of librarian am I.
Oh, of course.
I'll say I'm a public librarian. And it says, what would you like to do? Find new titles for purchase for your collection. All right. Sounds good. I'll click on that. And, my goodness. Well, there's a whole bunch of services. Booksinprint.com professional version. I'll click on that. Subscribe to booksinprint.com.
Uh-huh. It sounds like you have to be a subscriber then.
Yeah, I think I might have to pay for this before
okay.
I actually get it.
Well, it's good
but
to
there,
know. At
there
least
are that. Some public information
uh-huh.
is out there. One of them is called the OCLC, which
OCLC.
Is the Online Computer Library Center, which is OCLC.org.
Uh-huh.
And that's a catalog that you can search for free. And, of course, you can also search the Library of Congress catalogs for free. And that's at loc.gov.
And tell me that again, please.
Library of Congress is www.loc.gov.
Okay, great. Well, the listeners, they can certainly, if they want more information and really browse and look at those pages to see what this is really all about, can go to either one of those websites.
Yeah, one thing which I highly recommend is when you're putting your book together to search the Library of Congress, see if someone else has already used your title a couple times.
Ah.
Which, you know, although you can't really copyright a title, because you can't copyright an idea, ideas are trademarked, not copyrighted.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly will confuse people if your cookbook is the same name as a popular mystery thriller from last year.
You know, that's a really good point. I'm glad you brought that up because as a review service, we get books in, you know, as you know, daily, and it is very confusing when sometimes a book comes in with the same title, totally different author, totally different topic, genre,
mm-hmm.
different cover, but here we are. We've got two books, exactly the same name. And that's a really good point for them to go to the Library of Congress and really check that out. Of course, though, if it's a second edition of a book, it's okay to keep that name because actually it's probably a better idea to keep the name than not. Is that
right?
Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. My sort of rule of thumb, and it's nobody else's rule of thumb in particular, is that if the title hasn't been used in the last 10 years, that's probably reasonable that you could use part of the title again.
Mm-hmm.
And not really confuse people.
Yeah. So usually, aside from some of the classicals or some of the self-help books, pretty much 10 years, they've gone out the door, haven't they? Unless they become a staple or something. So,
you're down to less than 1% at that point.
Yeah, yeah, and then it's probably not as confusing. So back to, we talked a little bit about libraries and getting the Library of Congress catalog and so on, but what about bookstores? How do they learn? Do they also get the catalog from the Library of Congress?
Well, that's a good question, and it, by and large, it depends on whether we're talking about the mega chains, which is Borders, well, Borders for now, and
right.
they're having some problems, and Barnes & Noble versus any of the regional or small store or specialty chains like, for example, Christian bookstores.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take a look at maybe something like a Christian bookstore. That they would get their list of titles from all the distributors that they work with. Because if a bookstore had to deal with each individual publisher for every book in their store, they'd probably have to deal with 10,000 publishers, and they would never, accounting, it would be a nightmare, right? Can you imagine dealing with 10,000 vendors?
Yes.
So that's why they just pick two or three distributors, and it makes their returns really easy because they just go to one addresses. So their distributors would tell them, ideally about, well, maybe 3 or 4 months before a title comes out, what are the new titles that they're going to be pushing, basically. And then the bookstores will have an opportunity to pre-order the titles so that as soon as they're off the presses that they can get them.
Okay, now this is where I need to stop you again because I need some clarity. So when you're talking
sure.
about a distributor, are you talking about Ingram's and Baker & Taylor? Are those distributors?
Yeah, that's basically what I'm talking about, the top 3 or 4 tier distributors. And the line, I don't want to get in between, talk about the difference between distributors and wholesalers, because the line is really becoming blurry.
Okay.
Traditionally, wholesaler was only a place that would just take orders from bookstores, whereas a distributor would take orders and they would have an active sales force.
Okay.
That would, make sales calls in a region and say, look, this is going to be a really hot seller. You need to have 30 of these on your front table.
So you just mentioned something that I needed to get clarity on this, too. You said about 3 or 4 months before the book is available, the distributor will send a list to, let's say, the Christian bookstore. Who tells Baker & Taylor or Ingram, any distributor, that this book is coming out? Where does that come from?
Oh yes, now we're getting to the end of the trail here. That's a very good question. That presupposes that the publisher of the book has some kind of a relationship with these distributors, and that they're telling them months in advance that their new book is coming out, and so that's the whole supply chain really, because you've gotten to the publisher tells the distributor about the book, and distributor tells the bookstore, look, this is coming out, you should buy it.
Before it's even published?
Yeah.
Is that basically pretty much when the ISBN is obtained or assigned, would you say?
Good question. You know, I can't speak for how all the other different houses mm-hmm. work, but it's generally in that area. It's kind of a window of 2 or 3 months where you might be doing this. Probably, you know, distributors would really like to know 2 quarters in advance what's coming out.
2 quarters in advance?
Yeah, in like 6 months.
Right.
And that's the whole rationale, really, for the dreaded advance review copies and the big five reviewers, right?
Right.
Which are, help me, I forgot what they are.
Publishers Weekly.
Kirkus.
Et cetera. Yes.
Yeah, and by getting mentioned in those, it also alerts the bookstores to ask for titles from the distributor, who then orders from the publisher.
So what I'm hearing you say in all this, it's like basically 4 to 6 months prior to publishing, it's important to get all these numbers, to get your book out there, to get the ISBN, to let the Library of Congress know, to get the book title and books in print, to let the distributors know. That all needs to be done like 4 to 6 months prior to publication then.
It is about the time that the advanced reading copy comes
uh-huh,
out,
uh-huh.
And distributors would probably like to get a copy of your advanced copy of the book, which for listeners that aren't familiar, that's basically a mock-up of the book that's not completely edited and corrected, but it's like 95% of the way there.
Mm-hmm. Is it basically a galley or a...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. And, the distributor may make their decision completely based on what they think of your book cover. They probably will.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, so you're saying then the mock-up should actually have the cover on it.
I think that's the way that the thinking has come around in the last 4 or 5 years, especially with all the digital press technologies. It's not that hard to, throw a laminated cover onto a book.
Sure, of course. And would a sell sheet do? Do you think with a cover, sending a galley with the regular plain sheet of paper with all the, or the plain cover with all the information on it, and then a sell sheet with a colored copy of the cover on it, would you believe that would work?
And to really get their attention, you want to add a one-page marketing plan with, 6 to 12 bulleted items about how you're going to generate the buzz for this thing, which will make it worthwhile so that 90% of them that are shipped to bookstores don't turn around and come right back.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're certainly a handful of information here. It's actually a handful of kind of an understatement because, my goodness, I mean, this is, I follow the self-publishing forum, and my goodness, none of this is ever discussed, and it's something that I'm feeling is really important, but not only to those that are self-publishing, but also for the understanding for an author or a writer that is going to go through the process, even with, let's say, a subsidy press or a traditional publisher like yourself. It's important to know and be on top of it so that the publisher actually does this. Can't really assume, I guess.
Yeah, and the other thing that you really need to be aware of is the whole bizarre economics of the supply chain where everybody's getting their piece of the pie. Now, a full-service distributor with sales reps is going to demand at least 70% discount of your book. So, I mean, if you're planning it to be a $20 book, they're going to, be taking $14 of that $20. It's going to go right into their pocket.
Basically, being an author is, unless you become somebody huge, let's say, as we know some of them have, basically it's the satisfaction of having a book published, because obviously there isn't any money to be made when you're saying a $20 book. It's already the $14 is gone, to the distributor, and there's not much left for everybody else to split. And eventually you're lucky if you make a dollar on that, so as an author.
Yeah, and you kind of want to think, if the book is kind of a means to an end, and your end may be being a consultant or teaching workshops or who knows what your end is that you're really after.
Exactly, and it's the credibility. Mm-hmm. It looks pretty good in a vitae or a resume or a bio when you are an author and you've authored the book, especially if you're trying to create a platform. That is important, and so
right.
Then you say, okay, is it really worth it? And this is what is my end, like you say. So,
I mean, if your goal is to buy a desert island and live on it, you just want to do something else.
That's right. Buy a ticket for the lottery. The chances are probably greater, that's for sure. So, before we go any further here, I want to talk about imprints, because that then goes into the same as, the publishing. And maybe first of all, tell me what an imprint is, and then I want to just kind of go into how these numbers work with imprints too.
Sure. An imprint, if you want to think about it in the sort of the business school aspect of it, an imprint is like, it's like a division of a company, and it's also not like a division of a company. It's essentially a press within a press. Because if you've got a big house like, say, Random House or something like that, they can't really be known in any one niche. They can't really build a brand in one niche. So by dividing themselves into, the big companies, maybe 100 different specialty brands, which might even have their own product line managers, so that they they really set a tone for a particular style of children's book, for example. Then librarians and parents and whatever come to trust this particular name brand imprint as something that's going to provide what they want.
Okay, and so how does that then, so I know that you have an imprint from Loving Healing Press, you have an imprint.
Right.
So with that imprint, then when it comes to buying an ISBN, do you use the Loving Healing Press ISBN series, or are you then purchasing a totally different series that is just for that particular imprint?
Well, experts will tell you that you really should get a separate ISBN block for each imprint so that, I don't know, certain things are easier to manage that way. But as far as I'm concerned, it all goes into a database anyway. So I mix and match the imprints within my particular block because, frankly, I know which book goes in which product line. I don't have to, you know, look at the number to figure that out. I was just looking here on Penguin's page, and they have lots of different imprints I'm seeing here. Penguin Press, Perigee, Riverhead, Viking, Avery, Berkeley. So they're all little divisions that are known for serving particular markets. Now, in my case, the Modern History Press is really dealing with memoirs and things that are of a topical or current events, world events sort of nature, which is completely on a different side of the coin than my psychology and self-help book series. And in fact, people would be confused about what kind of book they were getting if I had a book coming up about a gentleman from Iraq who returned to his homeland in the middle of Operation Desert Storm, okay? And that's totally different than a self-help book.
Mm-hmm. So this, it would actually go under Modern History Press then, rather than Loving Healing Press. Is that what you're saying? Because
right.
of the different divisions.
Yeah. And it allows me to basically become a specialist in more than one niche.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I woke up one morning and say, by God, I want to take over the true crime genre.
Mm-hmm.
Then I'd come up with a snappy name and a new logo and a new website, and I could really, you know, focus like a laser on that particular niche.
And that would be still, but, that would be an imprint.
Yeah, but behind the scenes, the accounting mm-hmm. can all be done under the same roof.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same employees. It's
mm-hmm.
the same computers.
Right, right. Well, that makes sense. And so you, being on a smaller scale, can actually manage everything under one block of ISBNs, where I can understand that, let's say, probably Penguin, as you said, you went to the site and saw these imprints, they probably have the blocks for each.
I mean, it's mm-hmm. nothing for them to spend $1,000 on it, you know, a new set of ISBNs.
Right.
Drop in the bucket.
Yes, yeah. Whereas a smaller press or somebody that's self-published, they, of course, can't do that. Would be an advantage for a self-published author to actually have an imprint, or would there be?
Well, to really carry it off, you have to, it implies that you have a product line of several books. Now, if you happen to be a fiction writer who was sometimes writing in romance and sometimes writing in horror, then you certainly might want to think seriously about having a different pen name and a different imprint to develop your line of horror books versus your romance books, because you're going to send fans of one are going to go screaming in the other direction.
Well, I can see that it could lead into a whole other conversation, so I think we probably need to drop it, that conversation, and get another program, because I'm already having a bunch of questions on that.
Okay.
So let's
you need to think about in terms of like a 5-year plan, okay?
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
How many books do you want to have in the market in 5 years, and what are the areas that you might possibly go into?
Uh-huh.
And then you've got to work backwards from that, you know.
So, Victor, is there anything else that you would like our listeners to know about numbers? We're talking about by the numbers today, and I think we've covered a lot, but is there something that we have missed that you'd like to...
Well, we shouldn't get to one of my more nettlesome areas, which is the Book Industry Standards Group.
Oh, and well, let's talk about that.
Yeah, yeah, they have their complete sort of numbering system of their own, because if you've ever noticed, books in your local Barnes & Noble are arranged in a completely different way than books in your library. And so the needs of the Book Industry Standards Group are kind of developed around the way bookstores want to buy books. So they have, you know, very simple top-level categories like medicine, self-help, mind, body, spirit, fiction. And then within those, they have maybe between 20 and 100 subdivisions for each particular type of book there might be in the genre. So under self-help, there might be one for recovering alcoholism. You know, so all the books for recovering alcoholics get shelved in the same place. So really, it's kind of assigning your book to a virtual shelf where it's going to be in the bookstore.
And who comes up with this group? Who is this group?
Yeah, the Book Industry Standards Group is a nonprofit consortium where different members of from the large publishers and maybe from the bookstore chains that all have a stake in saying, what are the standards that we as an industry want to embrace so that we can all talk to each other, you know, knowing that there's thousands of companies in all these different areas from publishing to libraries and so on. They all need to communicate in an efficient way. So they develop standards for interchanging information. And the BISAC, the BISAC code, is just one of their many standards that they maintain. I actually contributed a code to their system a couple years ago. I did my first book, which had some stuff on post-traumatic stress disorder. I noticed they didn't have a category for that, and I couldn't find the right shelf, literally, to fit it. So then I put in a request to their committee, their standards committee guy, and 6 months later they created a new code for me.
Wow.
Literally. So they're very responsive to the needs of the marketplace.
So this isn't a code that you have to buy. It's just a code that you use. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's like a shelf
right.
of a bookstore where you would want your book to go. And these are usually done at the distributor level. So when you're supplying your information to Ingram or Baker & Taylor, they'll ask you, okay, what are your BISG, your Book Industry Standard grouping codes for your book, so that we can understand how to communicate it to the bookstores.
You know, I'm so glad we're talking about this, Victor, because this is one of my biggest beefs as a book reviewer in getting these books that come in every day, stacks of books. One of them is, and we're not going to talk about it, but I just want to bring it up at this time, is that people, the authors or the submitters, do not give us the contact information. We don't have a clue who sends in the book. So we're going to leave that for now some other day. But the other thing is, we have to spend time sometimes searching, what genre is this? Where does it categorize? I mean, you know, and I noticed that, of course, the large publishers, and I know that your books are like this. It's up in the top left-hand corner. It's simple. You look, you know exactly where to what to categorize it in, what genre it is, what reviewer will review it. Some of the publishers also put it just above the ISBN. But what I noticed that many of the subsidy presses, and especially self-published authors, don't have these codes. And it's just, it's a pain in the butt because we don't have a clue. And I've made mistakes thinking that a particular book was a novel when actually it was a memoir or something totally different than what, you know, and then I stand to be corrected and it's like, well, duh, how am I supposed to know? Anyway, so now I did my rant, so I'd like you to comment on that too.
No, it's like one of the great unwritten laws. You're just supposed to know that you need to provide relevant and catalog information on the back cover that, not something that you made up that actually conforms to industry standards.
Well, you know, and so here's an industry standard, and my other rant then is, why aren't some of these subsidy presses not encouraging the authors to put it on there? Like,
well, that's a good question, and I'm going to answer it with sort of a riddle, which is that you know, the subsidy presses make their money by selling to authors, whereas the traditional presses make their money by selling to consumers. So they're really only going to do what the author asks for. And if you don't know to ask for it, you're kind of out of luck, because they're not really known for customer service, because that basically eats away at their profit margin.
Well, you know, I believe exactly what you said. And so all you self-published authors that are going to be self-publishing, or those that are using subsidy presses, insist on having this code. It just, it's not only for us reviewers, but the consumer and the bookstores and the libraries, you know, everybody.
Yeah.
So,
what I like to say is, you know, there's going to be somebody who's earning minimum wage who has a box of books and your book is in it, and they're going to have to put it on a shelf somewhere. Where do you want them to put it?
Exactly. That is such a good point. That's a good point. A really good point. And so I don't know. Is there anything else that you have? I'm so glad we brought this up. So is there anything else, Victor, that we have missed or you'd like to talk about in the numbers field?
Well, I'm just going to direct people to, you know, join that self-publishing, self-publishing mailing list at yahoogroups.com, because, I mean, that's the best place to go for follow-up questions and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of hang out there, but I don't read every single message, because it's about 100 messages a day go through there.
Yeah,
so.
I hang out there, too. So we can just actually say to the listeners, if you know, join that group, or if you are on that group, ask the questions. You can also actually email us, too, at authorsaccess.com. But more so, do actually ask the questions on the forum so that the others can hear the same answers and chime in, too, if they have some suggestions. So, gosh, Victor, thank you so much. You know, you and I co-host this show, and very seldom that we get a chance to interview each other, and this has been extremely educational for me, because I'm not in this realm at all. I know what an ISBN is and where to find it, and my frustrations with the book standards, you know, codes not being on there and so on. And so what you just, the information that you gave us tonight is just totally, it's priceless. It really is, and I want to really thank you for it. And
well, great. This gives me some encouragement to get that darn book finished.
No kidding. Power publishing, and I'm going to hold you to it this year. It's coming out. I'll be bugging you until it does. And also, listeners, go to lovinghealing.com. That's Victor's website, and browse around. He's got some great books. It's a great website, and you can take a look at his imprint and just check out to see how he has accomplished his traditional website, a publishing website, and also how he's incorporating the imprints, and I'm sure that you'll get lots of information. Thanks, Victor. It's been great.
Great. Okay, you've been listening to another podcast edition of Authors Access, where authors get published and published authors get successful. We'll be back on the air July 10th, 2008, when our topic will be creating powerful book covers, and our guests will be joining us are Graham Van Dixhorn and Susan Kendrick. You can learn more about all our guests on the Authors Access website, which is authorsaccess.com. We would love to hear from you about tonight's show. Please send us your questions and comments to info@authorsaccess.com. Authors Access is a joint production of Reader Views Incorporated and Loving Healing Press.
And for Reader Views, this is Irene Watson in Austin, Texas, saying good night and thanks for listening.
For Loving Healing Press, this is Victor Volkman in Ann Arbor, Michigan, wishing you all a good evening.